On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We're checking in with the nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy group Forward Latino, working on policy issues at home here in Wisconsin and 28 other states. According to Unidos U.S., about 1 million Hispanics turn 18 each year and become eligible to vote. Join in on the Hispanic electorate. Key policy advocacy priorities, 800-642-1234. Daryl Morin is national president of Forward Latino and leads the 80% Coalition. That's an organization urging state and federal lawmakers to pass gun control legislation. Daryl, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It's great to be here with you this morning.
Good morning. Let's start with gun laws by reflecting on Uvalde 3 weeks ago. Most of the young children who were killed, as well as the two teachers, were Latino. What did this massacre cause you to think and feel?
Well, I think myself and probably every other American in the country harken back to the days of El Paso. When we saw another tremendous tragedy happen imposed upon, you know, the Latino population. But, you know, more than anything, it was frustrating and it was upsetting because for those folks who seem like, you know, seems like we have a school shooting every week, they're right. Actually, it's happening more than once a week now. So it's really beyond time that we take urgent steps to resolve these problems.
What steps have you been taking? What have you been working on, especially in the week since Uvalde?
Well, you know, following El Paso, we held a vigil and we were here in Milwaukee and Milwaukee Southside. And we were surprised when all these organizations from all around the state and even down in Illinois came on up to participate. And it was in that time we were approached by a number of religious leaders of different faiths saying, you know, as a people of faith, it's not enough for us to pray, but we must act. And that's when we put together this organization called the 80% Coalition that's calling for two definitive measures in any gun violence prevention measure.
You talk about the El Paso shooting, and that was 2019, the Walmart in El Paso, 22 deaths. And, you know, there was this Pew survey that was done about 5 months after El Paso. Nearly 7 in 10 Hispanic voters, 68%, said gun laws should be stricter than they were at the time of the survey. And I'm just wondering, when lawmakers aren't responding to public opinion or are moving opposite of what the polls are saying, how do you deal with that?
It's really difficult because what we're seeing nationally is we're seeing a wave of state legislatures that are strong proponents of gun rights, passing measures that aren't necessarily have the support of their constituency in those states, such as passing concealed carry without a license permit. So we see that there's certain legislatures doing the exact opposite of what their constituency is calling for. The whole reason we're called the 80% Coalition just because here in Wisconsin, you know, 80% of all Wisconsinites, and that makes up Republicans and Democrats and gun owners and non-gun owners, they all want universal background checks so that violent felons can't go online and buy a firearm. 81% want these red flag laws so that if law enforcement or a family member knows somebody's in imminent danger to themselves or others, that they could petition a court to temporarily remove that firearm. This, you know, from a voter's perspective, this is a bipartisan thing. It's just in the legislatures, certain state legislatures, we seem to be getting hung up.
Daryl Morin, president of Forward Latino, with us, leader of the 80% Coalition, both based in the Milwaukee area, as we discuss policy agenda issues, what these organizations are working on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Steve is with us from Sun Prairie. Steve, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yeah, you know, this whole thoughts and prayers thing is just getting so old. We need someone with some type of leadership to push that we need to stop any federal dollars from going to any school district that does not allow concealed carry. I don't care what you say, providing soft targets is just leading these wolves to the sheep. We need to save these kids' lives. Why won't we support concealed carry in schools?
Steve, thank you. And Daryl, what is your position there?
Well, the coalition's discussed this, and I can share that while I appreciate the gentleman's passion, we're in absolute opposition. We believe that schools should be a place of welcome, of learning, et cetera, that teachers should be focused on that. And just to highlight something, you mentioned earlier what happened in Uvalde, a great tragedy where so many young, innocent lives were taken. That was a school district that actually had gone so far to create its own police department and to arm those, their own police officers, to keep the school safe. And while I think we can look on that now and say that that effort wasn't as successful as everybody thought it would be.
Our Republican-controlled legislature had passed a bill earlier this year that would have allowed license holders to have guns in their vehicles on school property, and Governor Evers vetoed the bill. In this political climate, how have your group's gun control recommendations been received?
Well, there's no one solution that's going to resolve this problem. Mm. So our coalition has taken the stance that we're really calling for two things. One is to have universal background checks so that violent felons can't go to a private seller or even go online and purchase a firearm, which sadly is happening every day here in Wisconsin and around the country. And the second thing we're calling for the state to pass a red flag law. And the technical term for it is an extreme risk protection order. And here's another example. I hate to keep coming back to El Paso, but it's happened here and elsewhere, but most people are familiar with that incident. The mother of the El Paso shooter called local law enforcement more than 2 weeks before that tragedy occurred. Mm. And she pleaded with law enforcement to remove the AK-47 from her son. And they said, ma'am, is he 18? She said, yes. They said, is he a convicted felon? She said, no. They said, then there's nothing we can do. We do not have a red flag law here in Texas. And we saw how that turned out.
What are you watching for on the federal level for gun legislation that could have an impact here in Wisconsin?
Well, we welcome what we're hearing so far. Nothing has been passed yet. But we're hopeful, and we welcome the bipartisan communication that's finally happening. It seemed over all these years that regardless of the number of lives, innocent lives lost to gun violence, nothing had happened. So we're so grateful both parties from both sides of the aisle have come together. We're encouraged by some pieces of legislation, but once again, I think it's hard to say it's everyone's doing all they can if we continue to leave the loopholes in place that allow violent felons to purchase firearms online. And then number two, while we're grateful that at least from the framework we're hearing, that it supports grants that will help fund red flag laws implementations, it doesn't necessarily put red flag laws in place, and we know that is something that's desperately needed.
Daryl Morin, national president of Forward Latino, with us earlier this month. He joined Democratic state lawmakers calling for Republicans to act on universal background checks, as we've been talking about, and a red flag law. Join in what you think will unite and empower the Latinx community on ballot box issues. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap with Daryl Morin here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the head of the nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy group Forward Latino that works on coalition building to lift up the Hispanic community, give voice on a range of policy issues, join in on Latinx economic and political priorities, challenges here in Wisconsin, and, you know, heading into the midterms on gun legislation. 800-642-1234. Daryl Morin, president of Forward Latino, with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Patty now in Rice Lake. Patty, hi, go ahead.
Hi. I'm not disagreeing with, you know, better universal background checks. I'm not disagreeing with that at all, or the red flag. Daryl made a comment that not one thing is going to fix this stuff. And that's true. So that just the law is changing with a universal thing, if background checks is not going to change it. You need to do multiple things, and I'm including carry for the teachers or the staff or whoever in the schools to protect these kids. The second thing is the people that are getting guns are not getting them from the stores. They're not walking into a store and buying them. They're getting them from the black web, the black, markets. Criminals are not buying them.
Patty, thank you.
From a regular place.
Patty, thank you. Daryl, go ahead.
Yeah, and she's absolutely right from the perspective of, yes, when people attempt to go and purchase a firearm who are convicted felons from a registered firearms dealer, the firearms dealer is required to do a background check on them to see if they're eligible to own a firearm. When they find they're not, they're able to go to private dealers or even to go online. Some of the internet's most prolific advertisers are actually these online firearm sales sites. So that's where they're able to do it. And there's no criminal liability for the individuals who do that, because that is one of the loopholes in the current background check legislation we have. So that's why we see that as a critical component in any serious gun violence prevention effort, that universal background checks need to be in place.
Moving on to hate crimes, last week we saw a Milwaukee man receive a 10-year prison sentence for throwing drain cleaner in the face of a Peruvian U.S. citizen outside a restaurant. And this 2019 incident was prosecuted as a hate crime. Should prosecutors be charging hate crimes more aggressively?
Well, I'll say unequivocally, yes. That being said, the pragmatist in me knows that's a very hard thing to actually prove. And with so many budgets constrained in the judicial system, I really have to tip my hat to District Attorney Chisholm and his office for bringing those charges and for getting the conviction there. I'll never forget when I received a call from the sister of Mayud Velez. He was the victim in that just horrendous acid attack, requesting assistance. I think it was very telling that when the trial was concluded, that the attacker had said, I'm still afraid of him. I'm still afraid of him. Mm. And Mayud said, I forgive him, but I just want him to acknowledge that what he did was wrong. Mm. And he wasn't even able to get that. We've just seen a huge spike in hate crimes against, our community over the last 4 years. And Mayud, sadly, was one of those victims.
How is Forward Latino working on this issue, working on the issue of hate crimes?
Sadly, we had to develop a whole protocol on how we service hate crime victims, from making sure that them and their families are safe to getting them the medical and mental health treatment that they need, financial resources to carry them over while they transition and get the therapy they need, et cetera, as well as working with legislators and others. Another case we got deeply involved in was when Natalia Miranda, 14-year-old, Hispanic girl walking to school, American citizen. A person in an SUV, a female in her SUV, stopped at a red light, sees her, and decides to punch it, jump the curb, and literally, as she's running, trying to run away from the car, keeps turning and swerving until she successfully runs her over. Mm. And she told police she did it because the girl was a Mexican. Mm. Miranda and Mayu, those are two examples of people who were willing to come forth, but so many aren't. And for that reason, while we render assistance to many, you hear of so few of them, because understandably, they're fearful that there's going to be, more personal attacks coming if they speak up and report it.
Let's turn to immigration. You are set to travel to Brownsville, Texas, I understand, on the U.S.-Mexico border to get a look at the crisis there. What do you want to learn?
Well, we continue to see and hear so much from folks who have their set agendas. And while we have a policy in place, we want to go down and we want to hear from those folks who want to seek asylum to come to the U.S., who are fleeing persecution and war and crime. We want to hear from the Border Patrol agents themselves and from local city officials there, as well as relief agencies. So, you know, we can make sure that our policy is the most up-to-date and effective one possible. Whenever we close our minds and put our blinders on to only one position, we do, you know, everyone, we do humanity and we do our country a great disservice. So we're looking forward to doing that here next week.
How can the trip shed light, inform the issues Hispanic immigrants face in Wisconsin, especially migrant workers?
Well, boy, there's so many different levels to that question. Mm. Wisconsin is so dependent on immigrant labor. And, you know, our elected leaders know this, even some that have taken recently opposing positions to it in their campaigns. But from, you know, our dairies that use almost exclusively immigrant labor to manufacturing and more, we know the easiest way to out of some of the economic challenges we're having right now is to fix our broken immigration system. So we could finally have a policy that not only meets our security and economic needs, but allows us to maintain our mantle as being the defenders of human dignity.
Daryl Morin with us, president of Forward Latino, as we discuss priorities of his organization and policy positions. You can join in along the way, 800-642-2234. Daryl, you mentioned how the migrant worker community is such an integral part of the agricultural economy here in Wisconsin, especially on dairy farms. How are you approaching and working on better pay, better working conditions?
Well, we continue to work with different government and nonprofit agencies, and we've done this through Republican and Democratic administrations, you know, but we continue to really push on the need to fix our broken immigration policy. And I'll give you two prime examples right now that are used to create great division, which really don't exist. At Congress's direction, the Internal Revenue Service actually created a complete system by which undocumented immigrants are to pay taxes, and usually they're forced to pay taxes at a higher rate. Anyone today can call the 1-800 number at the IRS and say, I'm undocumented, how do I pay my taxes? And they'll walk you through that process. Now, when you hear so many people, particularly certain elected officials, talk about the issue, they never seem to mention that. And they just simply talk about individuals who are taken from the system, who are actually contributing dollars to the system and not eligible for the benefits in the reverse direction. Secondly, if you were to go to the Selective Service homepage, you will see there, and it is federal law, that if you're undocumented and you're a boy or you're a male and you turn 18, you have to pledge to defend the United States and register with the Selective Service if called upon. So these are some of the things that just show how broken our federal immigration system is and the need really to put reforms in place.
Are you working on immigration across organizations? I'm wondering if you're collaborating, as I think about, you know, the United Migrant Opportunity Services, and that's a Milwaukee area organization trying to improve employment and education, health and housing for migrants. Where's the synergy and collaborations on this work?
So we work closely with UMOS, who's led by just an outstanding human being and a great leader, Luper Martinez. He's their president, CEO, to so many other organizations, not just here in Wisconsin, but across the country, United Farm Workers, and so many more. So there is a need to make sure that, you know, above and beyond the immigration reform that's needed, that everybody receives equal access to workplace protections. Sadly, we saw during the pandemic, we saw essential workers going into particularly meatpacking plants that had much of their liability waived at the executive level, at the federal executive level, only to see so many, so much loss of life there. So we continue to effort that. Something that is continuing to be troubling for so many of us.
We only have a few seconds left here, but I'm just wondering, I mean, we're talking about so many competing priorities. How do you decide what is on top and what is your focus?
Yeah, it really is a challenge because everybody has limited resources. But today, it really is immigration reform, economic empowerment, gun violence prevention, And you know, workplace safety. It's it can be overwhelming at times, but we're great. We're lucky to have a great team here and have great collaboration with so many partners, both here in Wisconsin and around the nation.
Daryl, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Daryl Morin is president of Forward Latino. Ahead on the State Capitol Report, the editor of WisPolitics joins us to talk about developments with the State Elections Commission, the contempt of court ruling against Michael Gableman's office of special counsel. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. Dive into Wisconsin politics, taking developments one at a time. Some roadmap here. Your thoughts on the lawsuit over the GOP-backed Michael Gableman probe, who was found in contempt by a Dane County Circuit judge over how his Office of Special Counsel handled open records requests. And we start with the Wisconsin Elections Commission, its new chair, how you see the work of this body going forward, 800-642-1234. J.R. Ross is editor of WisPolitics and co-host of the state politics podcast Rewind on Wisconsin Eye's Public Affairs Network. J.R., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. So Rewind here to Friday, and the Wisconsin Elections Commission elects Republican attorney Don Millis as its new chair, 5-1 vote. What can you tell us about Millis?
He's a attorney. He was actually served on the old election commission way back before the Government Accountability Board. He was an appointee to the new elections commission, one that was replaced the Government Accountability Board, appointed by then Senate Leader Scott Fitzgerald, resigned at the time after a little while because he had a conflict with work. But he's back now. He's been around for a long time. He's known this stuff. And what's interesting is he's going right from being a new member to the chair immediately, because the only alternative was Bob Spindell, and that was probably not going to happen.
We're going to get to Spindell in a moment, but can you explain what is involved in being chair? How essential is the job?
Oh, you know, you run the meeting. You kind of, I mean, look, it takes four votes of that commission to do anything, but you are in charge of the meeting and help set the agenda. You certify the vote. There's this process that became controversial the first time that I can recall in 2020, where Ann Jacobs, who is now the past chair, certified the results of the presidential election. It was one of several steps that happens after presidential election. She certified it, I think it was on a Sunday, to try and get things moving. So you were going to go to a lawsuit or a recount, I think it was. So usually it's no big deal, but it became a big deal during that election. But it's not like you can dictate what they're going to do and, you know, force things through. You have to have four votes. That commission split 3-3 between Democratic and Republican appointees, was supposed to forge compromise. That, alas, does not happen very often with that commission. Often it's a 3-3 split on big issues. But you at least you run the meeting and kind of help kind of guide things through the process.
Millis has said state election laws need to be changed. Is there any knowledge of what he has in mind?
No, not yet. And we're going to watch that, because the commission can recommend things, but it's the legislature and the governor who ultimately change the law. So, for example, one thing that came up this past week was with the challenge to the Tim Michaels nomination papers, right? Or the challenge to the nomination papers in general. During the hearing on Friday, the seven-hour hearing that I sat through, several times there were comments from members of the commission saying it shouldn't be this hard. When you're having nomination papers and there are questions about signatures, it shouldn't be this difficult. There should be an easier way to do this, or a more clear guideline on what's going on. There is that issue. Also, the timing issue, because we go from having that hearing on Friday about challenges nomination papers, you're not happy with the commission's decision, you have to go to court. Well, ballots have to go to press by like the middle of this week. In fact, just moments ago, Jeff Mandel, who is the attorney who led the complaint against the Michaels nomination papers, tweeted out that they're not going to seek court review of the Election Commission decision dismissing the complaint because, in his words, not because they're wrong, but because an appeal would strain election administration. This issue also came up during 2020 with the Green Party's nomination papers. If you call back then, the Green Party, the vice presidential candidate for the Green Party, moved during the window to circulate nomination papers in Wisconsin. They had addresses, two different addresses on the papers, and didn't fix that. The Elections Commission deadlocked on a challenge to the nomination papers, couldn't get four votes to put them on the ballot. The Green Party then waited about a week to file a lawsuit. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin said, look, you waited too long. We're sorry, but ballots are already going out, and you're now asking us to put you on the ballot and halt this process. There wasn't enough time. Another example of something where commissioners have said we should do something differently than what we're doing right now.
Yes, and so some really good historical backstory there. I'm just going to reintroduce you for a moment here as we talk with J.R. Ross, Wispolitics editor, looking at the Wisconsin Elections Commission after its latest meeting and other developments at the Capitol. You can join in at 800-642-1234. J.R., just returning to the Elections Commission and Robert Spindell, who was the other Republican commission member running to chair the panel. And he was the one who had posed as a fake presidential elector following the 2020 election. What do you know about why he wasn't elected and the tension there about being that fake Trump elector?
Well, again, you need four votes for anything on the Elections Commission. There was no way you were going to get a Democratic appointee to the commission to support Bob Spindell for chair. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, there is the whole false elector thing. Being part of that, there are complaints filed over that, lawsuits filed over that, that Spindell was the subject of. Granted, the commission dismissed one of the complaints filed with it, but still, that was an issue. Even more than that, Spindell has been had a contentious relationship with Democrats on the commission the whole time. They've not got along very well, so they're not going to want to give the gavel to somebody that they don't particularly like working with sometimes or find frustrating to work with. Spindell also spoke, for example, in I think it was December of 2020 at a rally claiming the election was stolen from Donald Trump. You know, things like that are not going to instill confidence in Democrats about having him being chair. So that, you know, that's a big part of the issue, just those things. Now, from Spindell's perspective, he had argued that he should be chair because, actually, I talked to him last week. He cited a story that one of my former colleagues did. Pat Pobletti's now out in Colorado and doing very well. But he wrote a story about how before Spindell got on the commission, most of the votes were 6-0. Once Spindell got there, the number of 3-3 votes went up dramatically. To Spindell, that was because Republicans were no longer, quote-unquote, caving in all the time and fighting. In his mind, as a Republican appointee, he should fight for the Republican point of view on election laws. That also didn't sit well with Democrats.
Earlier this year, the House Select Committee investigating January 6th, they expanded their probe into fake Trump electors. What are you watching for there?
Well, just if anything happens, if there are any kind of penalties, then we have, you know, for example, Andrew Hitt, former state chair of the Republican Party. He was one of them. Spindell. It's been pretty radio silent about what's been happening since then. Now, again, there are some lawsuits or legal actions filed in Wisconsin. I don't know they're going to go very far. So far, the ones that we've seen about January 6th haven't really taken off. But it's out there. And what's clear is that the Democrats are trying to hold those folks accountable by finding ways to go after them. Andrew Hitt again. He's an attorney. There was a complaint filed about his professional conduct by being an attorney who participated in this endeavor. So that's something else you have to keep an eye on.
We have Wispolitics editor J.R. Ross covering the state capitol for over 20 years, giving us analysis and context. Join in on the Wisconsin Elections Commission primaries, how state races are shaping up heading into the midterms. 800-642-1234. We will pick this up in a moment for more State Cap with J.R. Ross here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kedar Chirkent. Next on to the Gabelman probe, we'll take a look at that. Also, primary races shaping up about 8 weeks out now from the August primary. Join in on Wisconsin politics and what you want to ask a veteran state political reporter, 800-642-1234. WIS Politics editor J.R. Ross with us for about 12 more minutes. J.R., let's look at the Michael Gabelman courtroom on Friday. There was Gabelman was in Dane County Circuit Court Friday, where he'd been subpoenaed to answer questions about his review of the 2020 election and how he handled open records requests. Gabelman refusing to answer questions, accusing Judge Frank Remington of bias. Let's listen.
You have a right to conduct and control your courtroom, Judge, but you don't have a right to act as an advocate for one party over the other. I want a personal counsel. If you are putting jail on the table, I want a personal, I want an attorney to represent me personally. I will not answer any more questions. I see you have a jail officer here. You want to put me in jail, Judge Remington? I'm not going to be railroaded.
Audio courtesy there of Wisconsin Eye. What did you make of this courtroom and the back and forth?
I have not been on the stand in front of a judge before, but I would, if I had, I would not have taken Michael Gabelman's tact with a judge who has my fate in his hands. You could tell the Gabelman chafed at the idea of being subjected to this proceeding. I mean, this is a guy, he's a former circuit court judge, former Supreme Court justice. He did not think this was something that he should be subjected to. There was a certain, I guess, call it arrogance about how he was being treated in this process. There also was, I think, one of the TV stations had a hot mic moment where Gabelman was kind of taking shots at Remington over his perceived bias, and that this was some kind of high point for Judge Remington. That's, again, not how I would approach being in a courtroom before a judge who can penalize me, but that's his, you know, that's the decision that he made. But this thing has continued to be an issue for Assembly Republicans and Robin Voss, the Speaker of the Assembly, because it keeps causing incidents like this, and it keeps costing taxpayers money. We're up now to about, so the original budget for this investigation was $676,000. Mm-hmm. As of last week, they'd spent about just shy of $500,000 from that. But that doesn't count the legal bills, because we have three open records lawsuits that have been filed by American Oversight. We also have the lawsuit where AG Josh Call has challenged the ability of Gabelman to force subjects to give a private deposition at his private office rather than giving testimony before a public hearing for legislature. The legal bills from that. We also have in Waukesha County Court an ongoing proceeding where Gabelman is trying to get a Waukesha County judge to order the Waukesha County Sheriff to possibly jail the mayors of Green Bay, Madison, Racine, and then city officials in several cities if they don't comply with his subpoenas. Their legal bills from that. We're talking, we're north of, you know, $400,000 last point when I checked my latest spreadsheet on that. So we're north of $900,000 so far.
In legal costs. Okay.
Well, between legal fees plus the $500,000 they spent on the investigation.
Okay.
So we're north of $900,000 for those two things. You get bad headlines out of it for Robin Voss and some of the Republicans, and you get a cost of taxpayers. That's causing an issue as well.
So Gabelman, as we heard in the clip, was really hyper-focused on jail time and kept talking about jail over and over. What was the response by Judge Remington?
Well, I don't think he really appreciated the perception for people in the room. He didn't really appreciate Gabelman's conduct. I guess I'll put it that way. He didn't really appreciate that. But he's raised this issue because that's one of the penalties for contempt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe there's going to be a formal order at some point because about what the penalties are going to be. For Washington, I don't know it's going to rise to jailing anybody at this point, but it is going to be another bad headline out of this for the whole investigation.
So Remington, at a later time, will determine sanctions, and so we can expect like a written order of what this contempt will involve?
Yeah, that was my understanding from the hearing on Friday.
Now, what about the open records request here? Gableman has released hundreds of records under pressure from American oversight attorneys. What have they been wanting here? What is involved? What is at stake in this lawsuit?
Well, they're trying to get a hold of all kinds of things. And the issue now with this contempt order is that I think it was like 80 pages roughly. You have to forgive me if I'm off by a little bit, but there were some pages that weren't turned over at the right time or when they first were asked, or there was some issue with those papers. And so that's what it's about. Did they comply with it? And during a hearing recently, actually middle of last week, the Office of Special Counsel, i.e. Gableman's office, seemed to suggest this was a clerical error by one of his aides, which Remington raised the issue of, okay, wait a second. If you're going to pin this on this guy, maybe he should have his own lawyers, because if that's your tact, I'm kind of curious about that and what's going on. So the question is, did they comply with these things? Are they fully transparent? Gableman said after the hearing on Friday that, yes, he deleted some things that he did not think were relevant to his investigation. And if he kept, I'm paraphrasing him, if he kept every scrap of paper came across his desk in this thing, he'd need a warehouse. Mm-hmm. That wasn't realistic.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this is a taxpayer-funded review of the 2020 election. That's not how it works. A public record. So, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to tell you what he has to keep or what he shouldn't, but I don't know that he's kept the spirit of the law at this point, and there are people who think he definitely hasn't, and that's causing some of this issue.
Is there any idea, to the extent of the deletions, the extent of the destruction of documents, and the nature of them?
Not from what I saw in the comments after Friday's hearing. He kind of gave a vague answer about what he's deleting stuff that's not relevant. And his attorney, during a hearing, and they all run together after a while, but there was a hearing a few months ago where his attorney said, look, he deleted some stuff. If it's not relevant to the investigation, we don't keep it. We don't think it's necessary. Again, I don't know what that line is under the law, or if Michael Gableman's keeping the spirit of the open records law with what he's deleting.
So as you mentioned, you know, these lawsuits seem to be all running together in a way. What will ultimately happen here? What is the goal?
The goal from American Oversight, I mean, quite frankly, they want to get the records, but they also want to kind of keep pressure on this investigation because Democrats think it's a waste of taxpayer money. Mm. This is part of the, you know, highlighting things that they're not doing properly in the minds of American Oversight. So there's that. We're going to have this continued fight about open records. We're going to have a fight in court over the next few months about whether Gableman has the power to force these folks to do these private depositions. The Waukesha County case, the hearing's been pushed back to August 30th, I think it is, or August 20th. Mm-hmm. So we're past the primary in August, bumping up against the November election for that going on. And remember, this is all supposed to be done by last fall. Robin Voss, when he started this entire thing, said we're going to get recommendations from Gableman by the fall. We'll use those recommendations for a package of legislative action that we'll put on the floor of both houses and pass to, in his words, clean up elections in Wisconsin. We are well past that now. And the question is, when's it going to end? Because once these lawsuits are done about like his authority, Gableman could pick back up the review of the 2020 election and start to try and get more depositions or records or whatnot. That's the big question. When's it all going to end? And what's it going to cost when it's all over?
And you'll keep up with that spreadsheet, I'd imagine. Talking with J.R. Ross, State Politics Roundup here, editor of WisPolitics. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. You'd mentioned earlier, as we talked about, Tim Michaels, Republican candidate for governor, entered the race in late April, joining the three other candidates who are vying for the Republican nomination. We've got former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish, State Representative Tim Rantham, business consultant Kevin Nicholson. How is this race shaping up ahead of the August primary?
Well, the Trump endorsement of Michaels obviously was a boost for his campaign. Now, Donald Trump has a pretty good record endorsing Republicans in federal races, right? U.S. Mm-hmm. Senate, Congress, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
His record for gubernatorial primaries is not nearly as good. Down in Georgia, Governor Kemp won his primary by 50 points, even though Trump endorsed an opponent, a former Senator Perdue. Out in Idaho, The Trump backup candidate lost by 20 points, the sitting governor. So it's not as clear that it's as powerful in a race for governor. What people have told me is Michaels has to take this endorsement and use it wisely. Go out and sell it to Republican primary voters. Touted. Within hours of the endorsement a couple weeks ago, Michaels had recut an ad that he was doing about immigration to add in the Trump endorsement. That was a fairly smart thing to do. The challenge for him, people tell me, is Rebecca Clayfish has done a lot of work for a long time to build up a support with the Republican base. So Michaels can't just go out there and run nice ads about what a great guy he is. At some point, he has to try and take this away from Rebecca Clayfish. How is he going to do that? They call them compare and contrast ads. Mm-hmm. I might call them attack ads.
Mm-hmm.
But is he going to throw kind of the proverbial political punch at Rebecca Clayfish? Now, to counter that is Clayfish hasn't taken a punch at Michaels yet. So what's that going to look like? Michaels, you know, there are issues about where he's lived for the last decade. He has homes out in Connecticut and New York City. There are questions about where has he been on the big Republican fights the last 12 years, things like right to work, you know, Act 10, like where has he been? He's tied to the road building industry, which wasn't a big fan of things like right to work. So there are issues like that he'll have to address. But those two are the front runners. I mean, it's clear that those two are the front runners. Michael seems to be boxing out Kevin Nicholson because of the same profile, right?
Mm-hmm.
Businessman, outsider, veterans, that kind of thing. Nicholson can't write a big personal check like Michaels can. And then you have Tim Ramtham, who may be closest to Trump's heart in terms of the claims about the 2020 election, but he's not getting much traction or attention, so he might be as 5 to 7% in that primary. So really, it's kind of Clayfish and Michaels and who can take the nomination in the end.
Okay, and we only have a few seconds here, but Governor Evers announcing a special session on the 22nd to take up a repeal the state's 1849 abortion ban. Do you imagine that the special session will happen?
Oh, they'll gavel in and out in a matter of seconds. They've done that on things like guns, on the tax cut he wanted to do, the rebate he wanted to do. Republicans aren't interested in this. One, philosophically, they don't agree with relaxing limits on abortion, at least not enough of them to do it. And two, they're not going to come in the summer at Evers' call and try to do something like this.
JR, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
JR Ross is editor of WisPolitics.com, co-hosts the state politics podcast Rewind on Wisconsin Eye's Public Affairs Network. This is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.